Right. Could you just give me your name and your role in the organisation first?
David Anderson, Director of Learning and Interpretation at the V&A. And that means that I'm responsible for education programmes, community outreach, visitor research, the partnerships that the museum creates with outside organisations, which are largely sort of to do with public benefit, public value, and they're either digital or sort of education programme based. Also responsible for diversity policy in the organisation, and have a sort of a wide or more general role really in working with research collections and other departments about other projects that turn up as well. So a sort of quite a significant dimension of the public side of the museum, really.
Thank you. Can you tell me how your interest in history developed at school and why you decided to train as a history teacher in the first place?
Well, I'd always enjoyed the subject. I mean, one just enjoys some subjects naturally and others maybe not so much, really. But I had a particularly inspirational history teacher at school. I went to a rather traditional and, in my view, looking back on it, rather failing grammar school, really, in the Midlands, in Rugby, Lawrence Sheriff. And the history teacher there that I had, a guy called Russell, I forget his first name now, had sort of, first of all, a huge passion for history outside the classroom. And that expressed itself in debates about contemporary historical issues, even like the Vietnam War, really, where that had come from, you know, what was going on there. Wasn't part of any curriculum we had, but nevertheless, it really engaged people like me in looking at the past as a source of understanding for the present as well. He was passionate about archaeology as well, so he used to take anybody who wanted to out some weekends to see field sites in the Midlands. He also happened to be an absolutely brilliant rugby player, and since I was pretty passionate about rugby as well, you know, he was a bit of a model from that point of view too. So I think that I actually took from that originally really archaeology, not just history, and went on to do history A level, but had always got in mind that I would do archaeology at university, which I did originally do 2 years of at Edinburgh. However, I began increasingly to miss the individual human side of the past, which I perceived history to be much stronger at than archaeology. And it was only really when I came to work in a museum eventually that I began to rediscover the individual hand, if you like, and the individual mark on objects as well as documents. And I think that reflected to some degree the ways in which archaeology was being taught at certainly Edinburgh, where I went to university at the time. But I suppose also it came out of the ways in which I in turn was trained as a history teacher, and discovered that the gap between history and archaeology didn't need to be as wide as I'd experienced it up to that point.
Mm. I noticed you said you had a 3-month placement at the Clark and Lyle Craft workshops when you were on your teacher training. That experience really give you your taste for education outside the classroom?
To some degree, yes, it did. However, I suppose it would be fair to say as well that, first of all, I come from a family with lots of teachers in the background. I mean, we're not sort of a Northern Irish family. My mother's a teacher. Members of her family had been teachers. My father's brother was a teacher. I mean, it was just one of the kind of career choices that was very obvious in the family. But secondly, I had been interested in what you might call learning in society and not just learning in the classroom for a long time. And I suppose that what I mean by that is that I've become very interested in the ideas of Tolstoy, for example, in education, and his emphasis on sort of practical skills and practical learning as well as other forms. Had been really engaged at Edinburgh as well in and inspired really by the courses that were to do with Gaelic popular tradition, song, and so on. And inevitably, if you're looking at archaeology, you're looking at primary sources that lie outside institutions very often as well. Okay, they're collected and pulled into institutions, but there's a great deal more outside than there is inside. So I don't. I think I'd almost started off philosophically already questioning schools. I mean, I'd had a very mixed experience with education in school. To be honest, if I'd stayed in the Midlands Grammar School I was at, I would almost certainly not have got to university. And was already reacting very strongly against the rather traditional authoritarian mentalities that I experienced as a pupil there.
So did you do sixth form somewhere else?
I did sixth form somewhere else. In fact, the family moved fortuitously for me away from the Midlands and down to Sussex, and I went to a grammar school that was just converting into a comprehensive school, just literally as I arrived, where the ethos was hugely more liberal and actually much more intellectual as well. You know, and with a few exceptions of the teachers in the school in the Midlands, it was politically grovelling to rugby school a lot of the time. There were all sorts of dependencies created between those two schools, and politically I hated that completely. In fact, my father led one of the campaigns to re-establish the school I went to, the grammar school I went to, on a different basis than had been done in the 19th century, where essentially the public resource had been stolen from the people of the town to create a public school there. And so I was already sort of politically at this one, you know, and it came out on the rugby pitch in a big way, I can tell you as well, every year. So trying to sum that up really, I suppose that I was already questioning an awful lot formal education, had a lot of experiences which made me value learning outside the classroom as well as inside it, was inspired by traditional elements in traditional societies, as well as writers like William Morris and Tolstoy. And all of that really led to me searching out opportunities like working in the Clerkenwell workshops.
Mm-hmm.
At a time when Sussex University had, quite a flexible teacher training programme that actually actively encouraged you, if they thought you were going to get through your year of teacher training, to seek unconventional places for teaching and learning, really. So I was, I suppose, in some ways lucky on
yes.
that.
So, but yet you went to a school, didn't you, for your initial 2 years at Oatall Comprehensive School. So how did your approach to teaching develop, and your school's commitment to the school's history project, how did that affect your teaching there?
Yeah, I actually learned about the school's history project not at Oatall, but at the school in Portsmouth, where I'd done my first two terms of teacher training, and they were one of the pilot schools for the programme. And again, it was in many ways quite an inspirational school. It was dealing with a very deprived area of Portsmouth, and they were really trying to attack that through their sort of programmes in the school, including their courses. And I mean, what I was finding was that the school's council history project resonated a lot with my own experiences, better experiences in history, really. The use of primary sources in various ways. The emphasis that as a learner you could play a part yourself in the interpretation of material as opposed to taking pre-digested interpretations. The fact that I could just see that kids were so much more engaged with that approach to teaching history and learning history than many of the traditional ways of working as well. And these were quite a challenging group of kids, really, from that point of view. So it seemed to me that it was both philosophically and democratically, you know, a great step forward, but actually also a very much more effective way of working as well. So when I got my first teaching job, I took that experience with me into that job, and some bits of the school's council programme were introduced into the school. I'm not saying, you know, because
so
of me,
all, yeah.
I don't all that was, yeah, because I think that the head of department, who was a great person, had already picked up some of the possibilities of that programme, but the school never went wholesale into the school's council curriculum. It just took some bits and integrated some of those into the into the existing curriculum.
Of course, it has a field study in it, doesn't it? So you have to go outside the classroom to do schools.
Yeah, but from what I can recall, OTOL didn't do that bit of it. It just introduced some of the resource-based programmes. From what I can remember, I mean, I may be doing their justice.
So
there.
What made you decide to leave school teaching and go into the museum sector?
Well, I hadn't planned on doing it once I was in schools. It was, in fact, I think my sister-in-law, who was had done a history degree at Cambridge and was just leaving, and saw a job advertised in Brighton, which was very close to where I was living. And she passed the ad on to him, and she hadn't trained as a teacher at that stage. So I applied, and the education officer at Brighton Museums got an interview. Had a rather bizarre interview and was offered the job to my surprise, really. He was asked questions like whether I thought it would be appropriate to beat children who didn't behave in the museum. the senior staff there were very, very out of touch with even what was current educational practice. And I'm not quite sure how much that was a serious question, but I think it was a half-serious question, really.
Was it a new post?
It was a new post. In the form that it was a new post, really, yes. I mean, there had been a post which had been delivering handling collections around to schools for donkey's years, and that had all been closed off. So effectively, this was the first time that the museum was really engaging with a full range of educational audiences in a proper way, really, there. Mm. But it kind of fitted in because, you know, to be honest, I'd never sort of thought that teaching in a classroom was where I would want to spend the whole of my career and all of my life, even though I really believed in schools from lots of other points of view, at their best anyway. You know, I'd already been round when I finished my degree to ask at the museum at Brighton whether they had any jobs going, and they'd said that they had plenty of work but no paid work, so that was obviously no good for me, really. So the museums had already been in my head, and in fact I'd been on archaeology digs through the university in Edinburgh, which had been museum funded too, so I'd already sort of seen the contacts with museums. But I'd been thinking about trying to train as a craftsperson as well, and been along trying to get apprenticeships as a blacksmith in the area in Lewes, but just couldn't find anybody who was willing to take an apprentice on. So it was a bit muddly, really, to be honest. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So was it a bit of a shock for them when they took you on? You know, did you introduce lots of new things?
Well, I certainly introduced lots of new things, and It was a good place to work from lots of points of view, because the director actually didn't interfere a great deal in lots of aspects of not just my work but many other staff. I mean, he was very good at choosing staff, if I could say so. I mean, taking myself out of the equation, they're a very talented group of curators there, very talented exhibition people, pretty well all in their late 20s and early 30s, and there'd been a whole new complete change of the organisation in the previous 5 years, really. And so I was only one of the last to be coming in on that wave of change. So I found that what I had was a group of colleagues who were very willing to be open-minded about doing things differently. You know, we worked well together as a group of people, small enough for it not to be too bureaucratic. And so I was, you know, within the limits of budget, and the budgets were tiny, I was able to do almost anything I liked, really.
So what principles did you have? How did you take it forward in schools?
Well, I suppose this is the point at which I rediscovered the role of the individual in objects, really, in all sorts of ways. You know, in a practical sense, you know, that every object that's been made by human hand is individual in various ways, and you can learn a lot about that individuality by studying it closely. So one of the things I was very passionate about was that children who were learning history should be able to learn history with objects and images as an inspiring and primary source. One of my criticisms of the school's council history project was already that objects and images tended to be wallpaper rather than sources in their own right. I mean, it tended to be still quite text-based as a project. Not entirely so, that's a little bit unfair, but nevertheless, the project hadn't fully embraced the potential of material culture. But the start had been made, and I felt by working in a museum that I could take that much further than the Schools Council project even had done. So there were things to do with learning through objects, really, that I was able to really explore in the programmes with schools. So I worked with the curators to get objects that could be handled by kids, discussed, analysed, constructing narratives of interpretation using material culture, ways of talking about pictures and analysing pictures to first hand. So I think it was also partly revelling really in the opportunity to work with kids with primary sources. I mean, in other words, not even just reproductions of primary sources, but actual primary sources. Yeah.
So did you find it easy to work with particular schools or particular teachers in the school to facilitate this so that groups were coming in or going into the school?
Yes, I mean, I in some ways I tried to do too much, I think, really, inevitably on that. I tried to do lots and lots and lots of teaching myself in the galleries and also formed some groups of teachers to develop resources around the museum collections, and also started up a children's club on a Saturday morning as well, and continued the existing weekly lecture programme that we had for adults on Thursdays, set up a new family activities programme at the holidays too, got one of the is it MSc? There was a sort of training and kind of apprenticeship programme that was funding around for at the time. So we bid for some funding for that and got about half a dozen young people who were largely graduates. I think this must have been in the early 80s when there was one of the sort of classic recessions, and one of the government's responses to that was to create these programmes. So we had about half a dozen people working on developing learning resources for schools as well through that. So I spread myself really quite thin across a wide range of audiences, and I was the only member of staff who was employed for the five museums in Brighton. The Royal Pavilion Museum, they then had a childhood museum in Preston Manor, had the Booth Museum of Natural History there, and also the Childhood Museum in Rottingdean, and then Preston Manor Country House as well. So there were the five institutions there. So I really was trying to cover lots and lots of things at one go, really.
So the other staff was sort of embedded in their particular museum, and you were the link person who was sort of drawing out the resources.
I was one of the relatively few people who was working across institutions, yeah. I mean, the conservators, to a certain extent, did the same as well, and of course some of the promotion and marketing and so on and so on. But it wasn't a big staff, so in practice, even on their own sites, people were doing a lot of different activities. And one of the things was to try to work with using the skills of curators to deliver some of the education programme as well as myself.
So did the schools just dip into that? So they bring a group of children along and you decide on the topic, or did schools say, we're teaching this curriculum, could you do something on it?
Much more the latter, really. And one of the issues for me there was that these things had to be teacher-led. There was no way that it could be any other way, really. But I could also see that many teachers were rather nervous about using museum collections, and you got members of the public floating around observing what they were doing. They themselves probably hadn't had any training in using objects for teaching. So I did try to set up a range of courses for teachers as well on how to use museum collections. But it was tough for them, actually, and I think that I sort of was struggling around the balance between how much should it be philosophically and educationally led by me, and how much should it be philosophically and educationally led by the teachers, because there is on both sides there's expertise that the other doesn't have so much, really. And if you've got a primary school teacher, I'd never taught in a primary school, inevitably they understand the primary curriculum and the needs of that age group of kids in a way that I never could. So it was a matter of, I was sort of struggling to try and find different ways of combining expertise. And I suppose what I ended up with was trying to produce resources which came out of the teaching I was doing, and came out of the expertise of a small group of teachers in the area who were interested in that, and between us trying to develop material that could be given to other schools. Mm. I mean, at this stage, there were far, far fewer museum educators in the country than there are now. I mean, I forget what the figure was, but it was in the low hundreds, across the whole country. It was a pretty embryo profession, really. So there wasn't a great deal of support elsewhere. You more or less came in and had to start to learn for yourself how to do it. There were no training courses in museum education at all I mean, I'd been trained as a teacher, but that was such a different world from the museum, really, that that you did pretty well survive on your own. In it.
So you didn't have a network of trainers across, you know, educators?
Not really, no. I mean, it would be a little bit unfair to say there was nothing. I mean, the Group for Education in Museums existed, but it wasn't a very big group, and it wasn't able to provide a really structured accredited training programme at all. You know, there were just odd days where you'd talk about what you did with families together, you know, go to a session and go to one institution perhaps where they did quite a lot of family work and just see what they were doing and talk about it with them, really.
So where did your ideas come from?
It's a good question, really. I mean, I suppose that you drew a lot upon your own past experiences, inevitably, and therefore the School's Castle History Project was quite a powerful one for me. I mean, I'm quite research-focused as a person anyway. I mean, I'd started off doing a postgraduate course in Irish history at the same time as working as a teacher. So while I was 2 years a teacher, I was also out in rural Ireland during my summer holidays interviewing the children of Parnellites and Anti-Parnellites, which was the period of Irish history that I was focusing on, and trotting up and down to Birkbeck to see my tutor there about it too. And when I started working in museums and didn't any longer even have the school teachers' holidays, then I just realised it was impossible for me to keep on doing postgraduate research in a completely different area. So I decided that what I would do, is in as far as I was doing research, was to do it about my, you know, in the areas of my practice, rather than in somewhere completely separate from it, really. So I began to be interested in reading what was being published about museum education, and to begin to publish little bits and pieces where I got the chance to do so. And gradually during the 1980s I began to get some chances to do that kind of research and publication, really.
And the wider areas of learning outside the classroom, so anyone who was writing about learning, you were interested in that as well?
Yeah, I mean, you know, being realistic, I wasn't able to read a fraction of what I would have liked to have read in all that. And I mean, one of the problems with museum education, I think just endemically, but particularly at that time, was that we were a group of practitioners, we weren't a group of researchers. And the university world was really not interested particularly in this area then, much more interested in it now.
Yeah.
So there wasn't really a kind of an academic hinterland to call upon. So it was a bit sort of jackdaw-like, you'd sort of go and find what you could really when you had time to do it. And it wasn't really until I moved to a national museum and began to be able to work in a different way, really, that I also began to get the chance to step back a bit and look at research and contribute to it much more actively.
So if you were to compare, you know, when you left Brighton, I think it was 4 years after you...
Yeah, 1985, yeah.
Yeah, so if you compare the when you came from when you left, what was there in place that you left behind that, you know, hadn't been there originally?
Oh, okay. Well, all that had been there before was the Thursday lecture programme and some children's activities from time to time provided by a freelance who was employed to do some activities. But that person in turn hadn't been education trained from what I can recall, certainly didn't have a depth of training in, say, history, for example, and therefore what they were doing, although, you know, much valued and much appreciated, I think, by the kids who came and took part in them, because, you know, she was a very able person in lots of other ways, but didn't have that educational dimension that I think probably were, I would certainly regard as being essential for your service. So virtually everything else was started by me, you know, the regular holiday programme, the regular schools service, you know, the publications, the projects.
So there was a network of links with schools and teachers who were actively involved in the museum
education. I mean, it was, I mean, I'd have to say that there were, I mean, inevitably there were teachers that I got to know because they came regularly to the museum and really liked to use it. There were lots of other teachers and even some schools that I never had much contact with. I mean, one of the things about that museum service is that there wasn't another education service within a 20 to 30 mile radius, really, from what I can recall. I mean, I think there might have been somebody at Horsham, but I can't remember now. Otherwise, you had to go as far as Chichester, at least, if not further, Portsmouth, Southampton, one direction. Heaven knows how far you'd have to go into the rest of East Sussex and Kent before you'd find somebody as well. So really the only substantial alternative for many of the schools in that area was to go up to London, you know, in practice. And I mean, after I left, you know, my appointment, if you like, was the start of a process of growth on that. And then there were two posts created quite soon afterwards, you know, a sort of a senior educator and then another post as well. And just because, you know, the demand was overwhelmingly greater than the possibility of supply. But I think that's still true for lots of museums, even now, if that's the case.
So do you think there are any other factors that have been important, apart from your teaching and your research, to the development of your ideas about the educational role of museums?
Well, I'd have to be honest and say that there's a very strong sort of political philosophy element to this, which has grown stronger over the years, I think, but was always there right from the start. And by that, I think I mean that I don't think democracies can operate simply on voting systems. That public education, in the wider sense of the world, is an essential component of democratic participation as well. And that in addition to representative democracy, you also need participative democracy. And that museums have got a, cultural institutions generally, but including museums, have got a key role in fostering participation. Now, immediately this creates a major issue inside museums, because there's one strong strand of museum development, which you could regard the British Museum as being the exemplar of, which is essentially that knowledge lies with experts and gentlemen originally, and that the role of the museum is to present that information with relatively few concessions, initially to a very limited group in the public, and then gradually through the 19th century and into the 20th century, and grudgingly to a wider audience. But even by the late 20th century, and I would even argue today, by and large, making no concessions or very few concessions to all the research there has been about how people learn and the whole field of social inquiry. In other words, disciplines are seen, like art history or archaeology, are seen as being complete in themselves. And therefore the only interpreter you need is an expert in archaeology or art history, for instance, who will have very little understanding most of the time. You do get some inspired exceptions, but very most of the time will have very little understanding and very little interest in what processes go on inside the heads of those visitors who come. So from my point of view, from an educational perspective and actually from a democratic perspective, it's a profoundly undemocratic model of knowledge in society. But the second element of that I find so objectionable really is that it also assumes that the only knowledge that's worth having is the knowledge that's inside the expert's head. And that virtually everybody else, I mean, whether they are experts in another field or have personal experience of some element of what they're seeing displayed in the museum, any of that kind of other knowledge, in essence, doesn't really count, is not of value. And I think not only is that democratically objectionable, but it's actually probably not very true either, you know. It just flies in the face of a lot of the reality of how knowledge is constructed in societies, really. In short, what one still has is a very positivist view of knowledge, surviving and even thriving still in some of our major cultural institutions. Now, this is jumping ahead a bit, really, but one of the things that appealed to me when I first came here to work at the V&A was that it doesn't come out of that tradition. It comes out of a completely different model of the relationship between the cultural institution and society. And that model was that, you know, whether one accepted or not now, but in the middle of the 19th century, that Britain was beginning to lag behind some other countries in terms of competitiveness in industrial production. The analysis was that there were a number of reasons for this, one of which was that designers and makers were not producing goods of a high quality of design, that as a society, design was not understood by the populace who were purchasing materials, and thirdly, that the children and young people who would be the designers and the consumers of the future were not getting the education they needed to fulfil those roles. So it's a very sort of top-down model of knowledge again, but it's one very much with an ambition for change, and in the process of that ambition for change was the need to reach the whole of society and not simply an elite group of gentlemen, really. Henry Cole, who was the first director of this museum, did a study of those people who were working in businesses, companies in the London area, who did or did not visit the National Gallery, and he found that in one year, I think it was, in his terms, only 46% of the men who he surveyed who were working in these industries and businesses had actually visited the National Gallery during the previous year, which he thought was completely shocking, because it meant that more than half the male population was not being exposed to a primary source on this. And that was one of his justifications for the creation of the South Kensington Museum, was this failure. I mean, one would hope the director of the National Gallery these days would be delighted if 46% of the male, let alone the female population, were to visit. But I mean, Henry Cole set himself the objective of actually reaching the working men and women and children in East London, for example. It was a very driven missionary ambition, with all sorts of questions to be asked about, you know, again, the model of knowledge that was had. I mean, Henry Cole had an idea of what good design was and was determined to exhibit it, you know, and he also even had a display of bad design, which he exhibited to uproar from the manufacturers who produced it, you know. But there was a total engagement, really, in all this, and an unwillingness to accept that the great majority of the population were not part of the process here, really. And that divide between engagement with society and, in a sense, standing back from and ultimately rather despising the rest of society continues as the philosophical divide within the museum sector today, in various more sophisticated forms. But that it's almost an unspoken debate, because many of the proponents won't ever come out and articulate why they're doing what they're doing. But nevertheless, it remains embedded in all of our work. And therefore, when I'm saying that political philosophy lies partly behind what I do, that has been a continuing strand. And I believe you can see traces of that in the School's Council History Project too. You see, that's one of the reasons why it appealed to me there. You know, I saw some practical application of some of the issues.
Yes, when you were speaking about that, it made me think about the new history approach, where you're intending to get the student to interact with the evidence and produce a sort of new form of knowledge.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, you know, there's all sorts of questions about anything that all of us do in this field, of course, but nevertheless, at its best, there is a respect for other human beings embedded in it, that people have a right to speak and a right to be listened to, whoever they are, really. And that's not simply a sort of airy-fairy idealism. It's based on the fact that there is, you know, as a whole society, we have greater value by that process than we would be by not following that process as well.
Thank you. That's a really interesting sort of philosophical background. At the time when you left Brighton, you didn't come here, you went to the Maritime Museum at Greenwich, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd been rather a bad lad in Brighton, really, in some ways. I mean, not in a way that any of my colleagues objected to, but the council at that stage was Conservative run and had been for very many years. And the chief executive wanted to get rid of the director of the museum at the time. And therefore set up a review of the structure of the council, in which one of the key findings was that the museums department was to be merged with the tourism department. And the director by that stage already could see the writing on the wall, and got a job, in fact, here at the V&A. But by that stage, the process was also well underway. So it was left to the staff then to try to deal with the consequences of all this. And a couple of us decided that we were going to kind of take a lead on fighting the battle against this proposal. And PricewaterhouseCoopers had been recruited to do the analysis of the council. They produced their report, made their recommendations about the museum. We then took those recommendations, challenged them, produced our own evidence, produced our own report, and all of which within limits was a legitimate activity, really, provided we followed it by keeping it within the council. But we didn't do that. We also sent it off to the local and national press as well. And at that point, all hell broke loose, really. And it turned out that the chief executive's position was weaker than he probably thought it was. And both the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats decided to attack the Price Waterhouse report and his way of probably attacking the Conservatives. And the council backed off the proposals, and a few months later the council lost, they moved from the Tories to, I think, a Lib Dem Labour coalition, if I remember rightly. However, you know, I had two kids at that stage. I was quite clear that what I'd done was, you know, in complete breach of my duties as a local government officer, really. So I thought I had to get another job. Mm-hmm. I got a job at the Maritime Museum in Greenwich as head of education there.
And was the approach there the same? You were going to try to open out the resources of the museum to
the public? Yes, absolutely. And then again, it was a museum which was potentially in transition from a very traditional approach to education to... well, that's not entirely fair. There were some things that were very interesting, very valuable in what was being done there. But again, it wasn't really looking at the whole audience and hadn't really had a member of staff who had schools background leading it as well. So I really, again, had the chance to rebuild, build it from, you know, not very much, really.
So when you mounted the Armada exhibition, that was your first really big...
Yeah, it was the first really big exhibition, in fact, that the museum had put on for some time, as I recall. I mean, that was already getting going by the time I arrived in 1985. The planning for that, and you know, 3 years later it opened, a bit less than 3 years.
So, what were your priorities for working with schools?
Well, for me, this was a huge opportunity, if you like, because I mean, for the first time, really, a really major national event and a major national exhibition was tying in with my experience as a history teacher. And I was really determined to use this as an opportunity to explore different points of view in history. In other words, the Spanish perspective as well as the English, and come to that, the Irish and the Scottish as well, too. And, you know, given that I'd been educated in Scotland and was born in Ireland, I really revelled in the chance to critique the English perspectives on the past, not simply to sort of apply the Spanish dimension, if you like, as well. So in a sense, it was a platform for Irish history and Scottish history as well as for English history. And I was very lucky, in, of course, that there was tons of primary research going on to reinterpret the whole event anyway by the curators and other researchers. And I was able to draw on that. But I also did some primary research of my own, small amounts really, to fill out some areas which weren't being covered quite so much in the exhibition, which nevertheless I felt were important from a history education point of view, such as how the population of London was responding to the threat there. And just little bits and pieces, really, that were to do with how foreigners were treated during this crisis. Because it told us a lot, probably, about how populations which feel themselves under threat behave to outsiders generally. You know, there were a lot of connections I felt between, you know, human behaviour in the late 16th century and human behaviour in the 1980s. You know, you'd had... all the all the comparisons which had been made during the Falklands War with the Armada, you know, the sort of association of the Spanish as being the baddies, and here again was the kind of opportunity for the Argentinians to be seen as the people who were the baddies, and you know, some national newspapers were making this very explicit actually at the time that the preparations for the Armada exhibition were coming up, you know, because it wasn't just our museum, it was there was a whole load of things going on nationally about this too. So it felt like this was a real, you know, alive contemporary issue and not simply an historical one, and I really wanted to engage through the education program in that.
Mm. So you had a lot of schools coming into the museum as well as... Did you go out as well?
Didn't go out very much really, no. I mean, it's one of the things, you always get far more schools coming into museums anyway than you can ever deal with, than let alone going out. I mean, I'd gone out more when I was at the in Brighton Museum. I'm taking objects with me into classrooms really there, but I didn't do it really so much in Greenwich. There was just an overwhelming amount to be done really on site. One thing we did was to negotiate with a publisher who since disappeared, but MacDonald's Books, that were pretty active at that stage, to produce a children's book around the event. And I also got funding with our development department, got funding for a very substantial teacher's pack as well for it. So we did a lot of preparation well in advance to try to capitalise on this opportunity really. This gave me one of my excuses for doing some more research than the exhibition project had done, because I wanted to really fill out the Irish and Scottish element of the story much more than was particularly ever done in children's books, where it was seen as very much at the point at which the Spanish are scattered by the winds in the North Sea, that after that it's just a kind of an uninteresting aftermath of destruction and failure really there for the Spanish. And I really wanted to explore much more the impact on Scotland and the impact on Ireland of all this really, and some of the stories that came out of that as well.
So there was a big take-up for the pack and teachers using that before they came for the exhibition.
Yes, and so there was. I mean, really, I have to say again that there was a lot inspired by the Schools Council History project, you know, and a lot of what I experienced and learnt through that I then applied in developing the pack. I mean, we did a lot of visual resources in it and activities for how to use the visual resources in the classroom. A lot of primary sources that teachers would never normally have got access to, and which weren't really very readily available even through the exhibition materials either. But again, I was able to select material that I thought would be relevant to schools and could be used to teach history.
Did you have a sort of teachers panel that you used to consult?
Not as a standing group of teachers, but again for this particular purpose, I actually formed a group of teachers and educators to help to produce some of the content of that as well.
So but that was aimed at younger children, wasn't it, as well? Primary.
Yes, it was upper primary into secondary. Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I have to say though that I was, I mean, for all sorts of practical reasons, as much as anything else, I had to take a much stronger editorial and educator role in that than I had done in some of the materials I produced in Brighton, because my timescales were heavier. This was a much more high-profile publication. And, you know, being honest, the quality of what comes out of possibly a rather random group of teachers forming together to produce materials can be very variable, and I just couldn't afford variable. You know, I had to make judgments of quality, and they were not always popular ones. But nevertheless, that's what I did, you know. So I think it was the first time a museum had produced such a substantial resource for history teaching.
And did you get positive feedback on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a bit dodgy saying that, because I mean, we didn't get an independent university evaluator to go out and talk to teachers and the rest of it. So I think I'd put, you know, I wouldn't like to make too great claims on that, but it seems so, yeah. Yeah, I mean, certainly some of the colleagues in other museums regarded as a kind of benchmark publication really.
And the exhibition itself, did you make use of a teacher's or even parents' expertise when you were planning the interactive galleries?
Goldsmiths College, we drew upon a bit in that, and I, because it was aimed at 3 to 8 year old children, which wasn't an age group I had a great deal of experience with, I did use one or two of the tutors at Goldsmiths to help me to develop that. I mean, again, though, we were under such terrible pressure from... I'd already proposed this as a general idea before the exhibition opened. It wasn't until after it opened, and complaints started coming in from families about how difficult they were finding it getting around the main galleries with kids, that the museum suddenly reversed its decision not to fund this. And I literally had something like 6 weeks, 8 weeks to go from no plans to construction and opening, you know.
So that was added in after the
After the exhibition opened.
But it was something you thought about before.
It was something I had proposed and not managed to persuade the management to do.
So that was a vindication
there. Of a kind, yes. But it killed me as well, actually, but nevertheless. Yeah, and I mean, that was very popular. I mean, there's no question of that. And from that came my first piece of really substantial published research as well, which was Learning History in Museums, was the article, really, which I published in a museum, professional museum journal, really.
So, I was reading the later publications. You've done a number of publications and reports. You published one called A Commonwealth,
yeah.
A really large study. It does appear that only half of museums were taking links with education seriously before the late 1990s. So why do you think that was the case? We've got half very kids. You were saying overwhelmed, but yet we've got half of schools not really... half of museums not really...
Not providing for it,
yes.
Yeah. I think the roots of this are so deep and from my point of view so depressing in some ways really that I almost hesitate to get into it really. But I think it partly comes back to the kind of the ideologies and visions of purpose for museums and galleries. And I would say that this has changed to some degree in the last decade or so as well. That it's nearly 15 years since I did the surveys which formed the basis for some of the conclusions of Commonwealth Report. I think that it comes out of the class system in Britain. A disproportionate number of people who are employed in museums, and particularly the very influential national museums, come from a class background that gives them little experience of the experiences of or the kind of life stories really of most of the children who are in schools. Many of them are educated privately. Many of them have never had to do work as students that put them into situations where they were mixing with the wider population. Many of them have had parental support to enable them to get to the point of being able to apply for museum jobs. I mean, this is a very familiar pattern. I mean, if you've come across the Sutton Trust
yes.
research, they've not actually done the arts world yet. I mean, I hope they get on and do it pretty soon. It'll be at least as bad, if not worse, in the major national institutions among museums as anything they've described in Parliament, the press, or the judiciary. So that's reflected in who gets employed, who gets the opportunity even to apply for jobs. I mean, I got into museums because I was an educator, and I kind of came in through one of the low-status jobs. And it still is, to some degree, a low-status job as well. You know, we still have debates about whether my department and some other departments are service departments inside the V&A, as opposed to core with a capital C departments. And certainly in the attitudes of some of my colleagues, not all of them, but some of my colleagues, that's deeply embedded, you know. So when it's not even worth asking educators about this or that or the other, because it's our prerogative to make this decision, even if it has huge impacts on audiences.
I was going to say, on visitor numbers, your key measure of the effectiveness of the museum.
Well, they were at a certain point for a few years for the V&A. In the late 90s, early 2000-2001, with the election of the Labour government particularly, the V&A came under a lot of pressure to explain why we had less than 1 million visitors coming each year. And the opening of the British Galleries, which incidentally have got a very, very powerful history education dimension to it. I mean, it was one of my colleagues, Gail Durbin, who was the head of schools at the time she moved into that project, seconded into the project, history teacher for more years than I was a history teacher, brought a lot of her training and understanding into that project. And fortunately, we had a curator who was not English, American, who was much more liberal in his view of the role of education in galleries, who gave her a great deal of space to develop that as part of the mix. So the British Galleries, for me, still stands as one of the exemplary museum projects, not just in the V&A, but among national museums generally, in history education. That's an exception, really, I have to say. And the V&A is more educationally focused on its interpretation in galleries than any other, pretty well any other art museum in this country. It's a depressing perspective for me as the author of A Commonwealth to think still how little progress we've really made in changing these ideologies there. I mean, it's, as I say, I mean, the Sutton Trust thing I think is very relevant. I mean, this is to do with, you know, the structure of employment, the structure of education, the structure of culture, actually, in this country. And I think it's more particularly English in some ways than it is Irish, Scottish or Welsh, you know. You know, so I've been constantly in tension with that ideology for pretty well all the time I've been working in national museums.
Well, when you came to the V&A, it was to re-establish the school's work. So
yeah.
What happened in the past and why did you re-establish it?
Yeah, Roy Strong had been through a period in his early directorship, I understand, I mean, I wasn't here at the time, but from one or two colleagues say, of having been quite open to development of education. In the latter part of his time as director, that had faded away. And in fact, I'm told, I've got no independent evidence for this, but I'm told by colleagues that he actually forbade them to provide services for children under 16 on the grounds that they were not capable of appreciating the works of art that were here in the museum, and therefore it was inappropriate to encourage them to visit. And so there was no school service whatsoever when I arrived here. Again, very little for children in family groups. There was no engagement with some of the major cultural communities in London, whose collection, you know, whose cultures are represented in our collections, etc. But, you know, again, sometimes in one's career you come across really inspirational people, and for me, Elizabeth S. Cole, who was the director of the V&A at the time, and has been hugely and unfairly maligned, in my view, for her period as director, was somebody who was determined to change the culture of the organisation. And I think still that we're still reaping many of the benefits of what Elizabeth did that time. Mm-hmm. Now, I do realise this is not the image of Elizabeth that many people have. She is perceived to be somebody who was, in a sense, almost, as a rather crudely simplifying it, being a kind of Thatcherite agent who came in and sacked lots of expert curators because she wanted to put in a process of crude accountability to a cultural organisation whose purposes were couldn't be defined as crudely as she was attempting to do. I found nothing of the kind when I got a job here, and I think the image of Elizabeth that was promulgated externally was almost a deliberate lie, really, from everything I could see, because I could see no correspondence between the hatred of her for what she was allegedly doing and what she was actually doing, as far as I observed it. The thing about, I mean, this comes back to the democratic purposes of organisations, really. The V&A's research work, which was the so-called reason for defence of what the staff who were there, was largely moribund. The outputs of research were minimal. The connections with the higher education sector were poor. The quality of curatorial work was very mixed. And what Elizabeth, and let alone that the audiences were very poorly served by the galleries and other services, you know, this was a failing museum. There is no question of it at all. And Elizabeth had an unconventional background. She had started off doing a degree at Trinity College Dublin, abandoned that before completion because she met a veteran of the Spanish Civil War who then she lived with for 10 or more years. He was many years older than her. They settled in London and she trained as a librarian. After he died, she then progressed in her library career from Kingston to University of Surrey and then came as the chief librarian here at the V&A a couple of years before she became director. She had actually got her degree through going to Birkbeck, so night school, had therefore not been to Courtauld or some of the other prestigious institutes, hadn't been to Oxbridge, was a woman, and from lots and lots of points of view, I think, was not who many of the arts establishment inside and outside the V&A wanted as director. But she was, I mean, she and I discussed what my brief should be when I first arrived, and I still remember this, and we agreed that the three priorities to start with were going to be schools, families, and cultural communities. And, I mean, that was partly because of some of the groups who were not really being served at all. I mean, it was a sort of a deficit analysis in part, whereas there were some services for other audiences. But it also came out of Elizabeth's belief that you know, the museum should serve a broad audience in society. And this didn't come from Thatcherism. This was not a... I'm sorry, I'm speaking very personally about Elizabeth here, and I'm speaking partly about conversations she's had with me. So this won't get into print, I hope, anyway. But I mean, I think that I see Elizabeth coming from a very different philosophical position from Thatcherism. Very, very different indeed. And one, again, in which there is a passion for democratic engagement, democratic accountability, a real care for people, actually. One of the things that always struck me about Elizabeth, which was completely opposite to the view of the hard-faced Thatcherite, was that, you know, if a member of the warding staff, remember we've got a sort of staff of 800 here in the V&A, wife was seriously ill, then it would not be surprising for Elizabeth to be calling him in the evening to express her concern and to be supportive of him, you know. And I've very, very rarely seen that among directors, let alone particularly of national museums, really. And she, I mean, from that point of view, she was a very warm human being, really. And she set up the research department in the V&A in order to take forward the research agenda. And because it had been failing, you know, not because she was attacking curators per se, but because she felt that there needed to be a mechanism for some curatorial staff to actually really focus on research. And she was the one who drove the creation of the Nehru Gallery of Indian Art, the Choi Gallery of Chinese Art, you know, therefore engaging very much with those communities, pointed curators who were prepared to work in what might be regarded as just a normal way, as opposed to an isolated, self-regarding way. And so they had the skills of sort of cultural diplomacy, if you like, as well as skills of curatorship. And, you know, Debbie Swallow is now the director of the Courtauld Institute, for example. She was the keeper of the Indian and Southeast Asian department when I first arrived. You know, Craig Clunas, who's one of the great academics in the field of Chinese arts, I think he's Oxford now, actually, was one of the curators who was working in the Far Eastern department to take these kind of agendas forward, you know. So she was appointing a new generation of curators who had a different view of society from that which the somnambulant V&A of the past had really had. I mean, I'm generalising on this, but...
Yeah, but for you, that was a major help.
That was a major help. Even before I'd left the Maritime Museum, and as soon as it'd been announced that I'd been appointed to come here as education officer, head of education, Debbie Swallow was on the phone to me to talk about how we could bid for an education post for the South Asian collections. Rose Carr, who was then the head of the Far Eastern department, was talking to me at the same time about how we could get a Chinese arts education officer appointed. You know, this was I was coming in with a sort of supportive momentum, if you like, really, in all this. And it was part of the Elizabeth Revolution. Christopher Wilkie was the curator who drove the development of the British galleries as a visitor-focused set of galleries, was appointed by Elizabeth from America. Charles Emery Smith, who was the new head of research, now went on to the National Portrait Gallery as director, and has, you know, has been another one of Elizabeth's sort of appointees, really. And again, rather like my very first director in Brighton, who was appointing relatively young people to take forward a new programme, really. Elizabeth, I think, was doing the same, really.
So within London, you say you're a national museum, but also you're a London museum. Have you built up a network of involvement with schools, particularly in deprived areas, to get them involved
Yes. I mean, it's, to be honest with you, it's come and gone over the last 20 years in various ways. And this has largely been to do with resources and priorities, really. I mean, when we got the invitation to participate in the British galleries, it happened that three of the staff who were seconded across from here to work on the British galleries were from the schools team. So we had a very diminished school service while that was all going on. It was a judgment. I mean, we just felt that in order to be able to create a set of galleries, and there are 16 galleries there that were accessible to children in schools, that that was an investment that would last 20 years or more, and would actually probably influence other galleries as well around the museum, which it has done. But for three or four years, a relatively small service. We've recovered it to some degree since then. We've currently got four staff, I think, who are school specialists in one form or another.
And their business is to go out to schools and publicise what they're
Very doing. Little going out to schools for the same reason here. I mean, I think that there's two reasons not to go out to schools.
Mm.
Maybe more, but I can think of two very obvious ones. The first one is we have very, very, very few school staff in comparison with the number of schools there are. I mean, why choose this school rather than that school? You know, it's like an ocean out there, really. So, I mean, the question we're always asking ourselves is how can we have the greatest impact, really? And for somebody to go out to a school in, I don't know, southwest London or something like that, it'll probably take the best part of a day for them to do that. So I'm not sure it's an effective use of their time from that point of view. But the second thing is that the most important element of the museum experience is not me as an educator, but the experience of the public galleries and the material there. And our role is to try to make that work as effectively as possible from an educational point of view for the schools that are going there. And as I say, we have far more of those than we could ever meet personally, even on site here. So how, I mean, this is an ongoing debate. I don't think we've ever got the final answer on this. Which is it best to invest in? Direct teaching, training of teachers, publication originally in print and increasingly now online of resources that schools can use, or fourthly, trying to influence the curriculum nationally as well.
So which do you concentrate your efforts on?
It's always to some degree a pragmatic decision, depending upon who you've actually got in your team at the time as well and what their skills are. I mean, given you've got such small teams, you know, I mean, we're tinier than, from our school service is tinier than the smallest, just about the smallest primary school, you know. And one has to remember how small that resource really is. I think some direct teaching is essential, because if we as educators don't have living experience of working with kids, then it's very easy for the resources and other kind of ways of working with schools to become dislocated, really. We do less of training of teachers than we did to start with, because I think at the end of the day, first of all, there isn't a great deal of evidence that teachers necessarily are very loyal to the institution which they've been trained in, which is not their fault. This is completely sensible on their part, really. But you know, what they tend to do is become confident about using museums, not dedicated to using the V&A. So we're just not convinced that there's a, in terms of our institutional objectives, that there is a great deal of connection between input and output, really, on, or outcome on this, if you like. But we still do some of it. What we do is to use it to some degree to test out ideas with groups of teachers that we may or may not turn into publications as well. Publications, I think are essential because, as I say, the great majority of schools and teachers, we will never have a chance to meet in person. And it's the only resource that the museum can offer them to support them in using the collections. And then the curriculum element of it, when we get the chance, we go for it. And there's a kind of period of flux at the moment, so we are going for that a bit. Mm. When there's no flux, it's probably not worth going for.
That brings us very neatly onto the national curriculum, because I was wondering whether the national curriculum had affected your work, either benefited it or detracted from it in any way.
Mm, okay. I'm probably not the best person to answer that question authoritatively, because we do have staff who spend the whole day doing that, which I don't do. I mean, it's many, many years since I last did teaching with schools. I mean, my role is a different kind of role these days.
Does it affect the way you interpret the collection?
It does. No, absolutely. Yes. No, it certainly does. And for example, in the British Galleries, the team who were working on that were very much aware of what areas of the curriculum were heavily used by schools in terms of our collections anyway. So the Victorians is one obvious one, for instance. And we're engaging quite a lot with the creative and media dimensions of the curriculum for older kids just now as well, because you know we can see a connection between what the museum represents and what the curriculum requires. We're always trying to see where those strong links are, but we're always going to struggle by comparison with, say, the British Museum. I mean, they've just got one after another of, you know, the Saxons, the Romans, the Vikings, the, you know, they, I mean, they just in a sense don't have to try on this. We do have to try to get schools to see the connections in a lot of ways. But we've also shifted our emphasis. I mean, this is me as a history teacher saying this. You know, in the 90s and early part of this decade, we did see history education as being a core part of what we were trying to do. With the development of the Sackler Centre for Arts Education, which we opened last year, in the preparation for that, we took a long, hard look and thought about, well, what really is our educational role? And decided that we needed to make creative design the primary focus, because lots of museums can teach, even the Victorians, you know, the Museum of London can. There isn't really another museum which has the collections around design, very broadly defined, that the V&A has. So we've now narrowed our energies much more into that area, and we're looking at you know, the design bits of the curriculum. We've also looked at the performance elements of the curriculum, but link it very strongly across to design because of the performance collections we've got here, nine now. And that's been quite a radical change, really, in our relationship with schools as well.
So a different set of teachers that you're targeting?
Actually, a different set of teachers, a more narrowly defined curriculum focus. I mean, we're attempting to be strategic about that, and we're strategic not just in schools, but right the way through the age groups and audiences as well.
So is that what you meant when you say we decided to go for it? You know, you were looking for opportunities within the changes in the curriculum? Or is it different age groups? Or?
Well, I think it's that's largely what I mean, is that looking at where design features in the curriculum and where there are strong links with our collections on that, and for the time being, leaving aside the history curriculum and leaving aside some of the other areas of the curriculum that, you know, I'll be honest, schools will always want. Mm. But given how few resources we have, we just don't think we can spread ourselves that widely. And I think this is about trying to be effective as opposed to trying to meet all demands, really.
Yes. I mean, you mentioned the role of technology and the internet. How has that transformed the way in which you educate or help educate young people?
Dramatically, I think, is the answer on that. For the new Sackler Centre, we've created a digital studio, and I think we're the first museum in the UK to create a substantial digital studio. And what we're saying is that technology is an integral part of people's lives now. I mean, any age group, almost really, but particularly young people. And that we just have to start to embrace that rather than regard it as a threat. Mm. Most museums still regard it as a threat to the primary object, and we don't see that at all. For all sorts of reasons. I mean, first of all, you'll be doing a... the mythical version of King Canute's thing if you try and deny technology. Secondly, I think there's huge educational opportunities in it. Nobody's saying that it's about forgetting about primary sources at all, but it is about two things, really. I think, first of all, alternative ways of interpreting those primary sources, and secondly, that some things digital are themselves now primary culture, you know, which need to be interpreted and understood in those terms. They are objects in themselves, even though museums are struggling to collect and interpret them. Mm. And I mean, the V&A was the first museum in the world actually to collect photography back in the 1850s. As a defined area of collection. Mm. So I think it's completely appropriate for us to be embracing collection of the digital now and interpretation of the digital. So we've put a strong marker down that that's a core part of all our work to do that. And that then means that we're also engaged in quite a lot of online projects. And I don't know whether you've seen one or two of these mentioned on the web, but there's one called National Museums Online Learning Project.
Yeah.
Which is still sort of struggling through its beta version, really, but is partly curriculum focused and partly adult learning focused. And this is an example of the kind of partnership building that's part of my job now, is to try to bring together groups of partners around around new educational initiatives.
Mm. That sort of shows the way it's going to go, doesn't it, in actually spreading the artefacts and the information that the museum has to an even wider public, because it could be immediately available online. In a Commonwealth, one of the key themes is this fact that for children from really poor socioeconomic backgrounds, often a school visit or school contact is going to be the only way they have access to this cultural resource. So how is that
I didn't really answer that part of your question as I think back on that. Mm. We have tried where we get. We rely a lot upon project funding. I mean, we have a tiny real revenue budget to work with. So funding like the strategic commissioning money, which DCMS and DCSF, DFES, etc., have been putting in to work with regional museums to reach children in the schools that tend not to visit museums, has been really important for us, and we're always trying to engage those schools when we get a chance on our programmes.
Mm-hmm.
I still personally think that there is likely to be quite a wide gap, particularly at the secondary school age range, in socioeconomic terms, between the schools that visit and the schools that don't, if you like, the self-guided visit that we don't prompt. So where we have got the power to intervene and to prompt, we are trying to reach the underrepresented schools, if you like.
Well, you send them more information, or...?
Well, or we actually quite deliberately target and work through local authorities to some degree on this, to reach schools that are you know, in their view and our view, most in need of the opportunity to participate as well. And we've also had a strategic partnership with the what was NCH, Action for Children, I think they've now called themselves too. And so I always have tried to make them part of any projects we're doing with young people in schools, because there's that whole other group of kids who may not even be in the school system, in fact, really, for all sorts of reasons. And I mean, this is, I suppose, is a sort of a source of continued frustration for me, really, because it feels to me that if government actually really wanted to take all this seriously, they could do a lot more than they're doing. And we tend to get funding starting and stopping and shifting about. And there are so many projects in the arts and education field. Creative partnerships funded through the Arts Council is a case in point. But I cannot see sufficient strategic consistency in it, really. And that money, I think, could be deployed much more effectively if we set ourselves a very clear goal of trying to engage the most disadvantaged schools in culture. But one of the reasons why, going back to the question about why museums are not more engaged with education, really, this means quite profound change for cultural institutions. It's not simply a matter of there being more education programmes going on. It does mean looking at how galleries are displayed and how material in galleries is interpreted. It means looking at your collecting policy. It looks at the balance of your budgets, really, and how those are deployed. And those are very controversial areas, and inevitably the sort of interdepartmental politics and interprofessional politics of the museum sector I mean, we were much less cohesive than the school sector is. I mean, I went from being a comprehensive school in, and basically we all taught the same group of kids and we all had the same issues really across our different subjects for the most part. Going into an organisation where the professional groups have very little understanding of each other's jobs, you know, at all, and certainly have very little comparison in what we do in our jobs too. And particularly in very large organisations, that means that inevitably there's a great deal of separation and lack of understanding, really. And a lot of people don't want to have those changes, you know.
Do you think that there's going to be sort of struggle in the future between those who don't want better and those who do?
Why should the future be any different to the past on this one?
Is it part of our sort of democratic future, participatory future, that cultural institutions will be more subject to questioning about the way in which they display and publicise their collection?
I'm sure that'll be true. I suppose my worry is that the quality of the questioning may not be of a terribly high standard. So, in other words, inevitably, ministers, when appointed, are thinking about a 2 or 3 year horizon at most, you know. And anything that doesn't have an announceable impact within that period is not, particularly in this field, which is, I think, still regarded as being quite marginal in educational policy, really, if it's not going to produce those kind of results very quickly, then I don't think it's going to be a high priority. And I think the other thing too is that, to be honest, I think some of the most powerful directors of national museums, like Neil McGregor at the British Museum, have a much stronger voice with the media and the public than any minister does. And if it comes to a stand-up debate between the minister and one or two of the really major national museum directors, there is no question about who the press will tend to follow. I mean, you come back to this whole question of the kind of arts coverage in the media as well. You know, education features very, very little in that. You know, we have a media that largely, again, has bought into a quite exclusive agenda for the arts. And assesses artistic experiences on aesthetic grounds, which is entirely legitimate, but doesn't assess them in terms of engagement, really, as well. And there are very, very few journalists who are interested or prepared to look at that question.
So, at the end of the day, there's a tremendous potential for greater involvement with children's schools,
yeah.
But the barriers are still quite...
barriers are really strong, and I suppose my worry is that... we have squandered an opportunity in the last decade or so to make much more progress than we actually did.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder whether that opportunity is going to be there in the decade to come, really, for all sorts of reasons, financial, economic and so on, but actually maybe philosophical as well, you know.
It's a sad note on which to finish.
Well, kind of, really, yes, except that I suppose that I never think that any battle is completely lost. My metaphor for this one is that this comes back to my Irish history research, really, that if you know about the Parnellites and Charles Stuart Parnell, the rest of it, that when Parnell's affair with Kitty O'Shea was exposed, the Irish parliamentary party split between Parnellites and anti-Parnellites. The Parnellites were only probably about 10-15% of the party. Very tiny group. Church was against them. A lot of people became disillusioned with constitutional politics in the 1890s in Ireland, and went off into the land movement, the literary movement, and lots of other areas of public life, really. And you know, were active and energetic, and produced change in all sorts of ways in that. And it looked as though the constitutional roots had kind of died, And also that, you know, that the status quo was pretty well immovable as well. But then with 1916, and you know, the public reaction against what happened, what the British did in 1916, I think could not have been as strong if the land movement and the literary movement and all the rest of it had not been going on. And so in some ways that energy, which had got sort of squashed out of the centre of power and disseminated into all sorts of other areas, did come back in very strongly at that stage. Now, again, one wouldn't like all the consequences of that, and I think it was a sort of rather terrible consequences for Ireland of some of this, really. But nevertheless, there's no question that the apparently strong position of the traditional constitutional nationalists, the ones who'd really been against Parnell, crumbled very rapidly in all this, and it wasn't as strong as it looked. So I always think that things may be better than they seem.
Thank you very much. Thank you.